Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I'm proud to bring you one of our legacy shows, The Pep Talk, hosted by John Carl Pepe. Greetings and welcome, John. How are you?
Excellent, Hercules. How are you today?
I'm doing great, and as always, I'm looking forward to your show. If you need me, just holler.
You got it. Well, thank you, everyone, for coming to a very special Thursday episode of The Pep Talk. We are kicking off our 4th of July Independence Day weekend spectacular because they made 4th of July on a Tuesday this week or this year, and I have to work on Tuesdays. So I really want to just do a quick program note because we will have another show on Sunday, July 2nd. And my guest will be journeyman actor Brian Scambotti, and we're going to talk about his career path and where he has been and where he's at now, and being a teacher as well as an actor and a new father as well. And if you're a fan of The Blacklist, he just did an episode of The Blacklist that just finished airing tonight. So I DVR'd it because I had to prepare for this. But if you want to catch a little bit of Brian Scambotti on the critically acclaimed The Blacklist television show, definitely check that one out because I'm sure it's streaming now that it is aired. And then we'll talk a little bit about that on Sunday. But tonight, we are here to talk about probably one of the greatest Major League Baseball franchises in the history of the sport, and that is the New York Yankees. And as those of you know, my father, Phil Pepe, was the beat reporter for the New York Daily News covering the Yankees during the dynasty in the late 70s and through the 80s as well. And basically, the Yankees did help put me and my siblings through high school, college, and beyond because they were a very successful team and a very well-known team. And the reason they were so well-known is really because of the efforts of my first guest tonight. He was the PR director for the New York Yankees during that dynasty, worked hand-in-hand closely with George Steinbrenner, and has done numerous work for the organization since then. He is a lifelong Yankees fan, and we'll talk a little bit about it, but he has also written 25 books, and believe it or not, most of them are about the Yankees, including what is considered the definitive history of the New York Yankees, Pinstripe Empire. And he has a new book called Pinstripes by the Tail, Half a Century in and Around Yankees Baseball, and we're going to talk a lot about that tonight. So, ladies and gentlemen, my first guest this evening, welcome Marty Appel.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and thanks for the kind words. And while we're in the kind words department, your dad was an inspiration to me. He was a lot more than just the Yankees beat reporter for the Daily News. He was a columnist, and he was a mentor to our whole generation of younger sports writers and publicists, and I loved him dearly.
Thank you. Yes, he, well, obviously he was a lot more than just that to me. He was my dad, and he did a really good job with us and always made sure that, you know, there was a wide spectrum of focus, you know, not just on sports, because he knew we were, you know, going to be immersed in that, but he definitely encouraged my love of pop culture, of movies, television, comic books, literature, and theater as well. So he always made sure that we were as well-rounded as could be. And that really means a lot to me that you said that, because one of the things that I loved about your book, Pinstripes by the Tail, is that it's very similar to a book that turned out to be my father's final book, Yankee Doodles, where it was these short anecdotes of you know, his time covering the Yankees. And it was really fun, and it struck a notion in my mind back then, like, wow, something like this, you know, maybe this is also because of the Bronx's Burning miniseries of ESPN, it's something like this that would make a great anthology-type television show, but really with a framing sequence of a reporter or an insider that you would be following. And I read your book, and I was like, oh, my gosh, that's the show. There's a connecting tissue throughout each of the chapters or innings of your book that really gives it this really natural flow, but also really strengthens the emotion of the experiences behind it. So really, I guess my first question before we kind of get into a little bit about your career, but my first question is, what made you decide this to be your next book with this format? Because it is a very, I mean, it is part memoir, but it is, again, it is a, I feel like it's a companion a bit to Pinstripe Empire in that it gives personal anecdotes to the facts and the stats, so to speak, which is something that I love in the best of sports writing. So,
you know what you said, you hit all the right notes there. You gave me a great lead in to talk about the book, because when I was a little kid and older, my parents had a lot of books in the house that were sort of short tales, short stories, followed by a photo and then a lot of white space. And they jumped from one to another, and you could read it in 5 or 10 minutes and, you know, continue on the next time. So I thought I was done. I didn't think I had any more books in me. The opus had been Pinstripe Empire, which was the complete history of the Yankees, which is still on sale and updated through the 2020 season. But my agent said, you know what, you're a pretty good storyteller. Why don't you put all your stories on paper and let's see what we have? So in 4 weeks, I wrote the whole thing. And I just sat down at the keyboard, and one story in my mind would lead to another and then another, and on we went. And when I turned it in, we got a publisher, and when I turned it in, I spoke for the first time to the editor, and I said, I know what you're going to say. The stories need to better connect. There needs to be a flow from one to the other. And what I want to tell you is, no, that doesn't have to happen. Picture five guys sitting around a table at Applebee's telling stories. Nobody cares if they connect one to the other. And so she laughed and she said, okay, I'm buying it. So that's the book. It's like a lot of tales and stories that wouldn't really make it into the history of the Yankees, a more serious book.
Yeah.
This is stories like me walking on Fifth Avenue with Whitey Ford for 8 blocks, and nobody recognized Whitey Ford. And I turned to him and I said, we've walked 8 blocks in the middle of the day in New York City, and nobody recognized you? What's up with that? And he said to me, it's because I'm walking with you. If I was walking with Mickey Mantle, we'd have a police escort. So that kind of captures the essence of Whitey Ford, the ultimate street guy in New York City, street smart.
Yep.
And the essence of me being sort of the second figure in a lot of these stories, but witness to all these tales involving famous people.
It is. It's sort of a little bit of like a Zelig concentrated on the Yankees, organization in some respects, because you were there for a lot of pivotal events. One anecdote that I kind of love that you kind of mentioned in passing is the George Steinbrenner making you redo the 1976 yearbook because their hair was too long.
Right.
which as a Simpsons fan resonates with me, because again, this is the reach of Yankees pop culture, Yankees into pop culture, and the reach of George as well, because he was such a huge pop culture figure. But there was a Simpsons episode, Homer at the Bat, where Mr. Burns buys all the greatest baseball players of like 1991-92 at that time. And one recurring bit is he keeps riding Don Mattingly about his long hair, and to the point where Mattingly has to shave his head, like the sides of his head, and it's still not good enough for Mr. Burns. You know, it is a very George Steinbrenner, gag.
Right.
There for a lot of that. And, one of the books – oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I used to be asked all the time, what's George Steinbrenner like? What's it like to work for George Steinbrenner? And it used to take me a long time to answer because he was a pretty complex guy with a lot of pluses and a lot of minuses. And then along came the Seinfeld show and a character portraying George Steinbrenner, and I was able to just say, Well, it's just like the Seinfeld show, and that was all I had to say.
Well, your time with the Yankees organization certainly was much more successful than George Costanza's and on that show. And you started at a very young age, at 19?
Yes, I was looking for a summer job in the Yankee organization. I didn't even know what jobs there were, but I wrote a letter to Bob Fischel, their public relations director, who you knew. Mm-hmm. And I just said...
Yeah, he's the reason I was born, according to some stories.
So I just
his
said...
His retirement party was,
I'm sports editor of my college newspaper, and I love baseball, I love the Yankees, and I'd love to have a summer job there. And it was in the late 60s when baseball was really down. It wasn't a great time period for baseball. Young fans were going to football and basketball. And so people weren't writing letters looking to the Yankees for summer jobs. So it was kind of the only letter that they got. And at the same time, Bob Fischel had in his office like six cartons of unanswered Mickey Mantle fan mail. So here comes my letter looking for a job, and bang, I get hired to answer Mickey Mantle's fan mail and go through those six boxes just as a start. So that put me in daily contact pretty much with Mick and started my Yankee career, which eventually I succeeded Bob Fischel as the team's PR director. It was fortuitous and good timing, and part of it was that baseball was in a down period without a lot of people looking for jobs there.
And you really did help develop the Yankees as a brand, pretty much along with George. I think that partly was George's intention with the team. I think he saw the brand potential that this could be, America's baseball team.
That's a good observation
you
on your part.
That.
I mean, if you travel around the world today, you see everybody all over the world wearing Yankee caps. And he saw that when he bought the team in the early 70s. He saw this as a brand as famous as Coca-Cola and Exxon Mobil. So he had vision for the future, and it kind of came true because they may not make as much money as Coca-Cola does, but, boy, everybody knows the New York Yankees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yankees, blue jeans, Coca-Cola. That is America to a lot of the world, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And it's funny because, there is this sort of, this stigma, I guess, or this perception of George, but a lot of people definitely love him for what he did with the team. When we talk about emotion in sports writing, one of my dad's books, The Ballad of Billy and George, I feel is his most emotional piece because he really does capture that relationship between these two very complicated men who loved each other, absolutely through and through, but in that love really had a tough time working together at times. And I think that he did a good job of capturing that relationship, which I think you helped see through to television in the Bronx is Burning miniseries that was on ESPN back in 2007, because you were an executive producer on that, I believe.
I was a consulting producer, and it was on ESPN. I think it was 7 or 8 parts. And it really got the nation's attention at the time that it aired because it mixed in other pop culture events of the time. And it was an honor to be associated with that project.
Yeah. Yeah, and now I guess you did not make it into the show as a character, but my father
I did.
He was portrayed in – oh, you did. Who played you in the show?
I played myself 30 years younger.
and without computer – that's right. And without computer de-aging.
It was just one scene. It was the day that the Yankees signed Reggie Jackson as a free agent.
Yes.
And the announcement was done at the old Americana Hotel on 7th Avenue in New York. And the director just said, would you like to play yourself? You were part of that story. So to my great amusement, they had a makeup person and a wardrobe person that turned me into myself 30 years younger, and that was a thrill to be able to do something like that.
That's right, that's right. Well, my father talked about when he was invited down to the set because he had a cameo. He had an unnamed cameo as, you know, generic sports writer, which was separate from the actor who played him in three episodes with dialogue. But he talked about being brought to John Turturro's trailer to meet John Turturro. And he walked up, and John Turturro's back was to him, and he was in costume as Billy Martin. And he said the chill ran down his spine because he just, from behind, he was like, that's Billy. And then Turturro turns around, and it was like, oh, my God, that is Billy. Like, the makeup on that show, it was fantastic.
It's funny that you mentioned that, John, because a lot of people watching the show complained about his prosthetic ears, that they were too big, and they weren't. And so I put in Pinstripes by the Tail a picture of the real Billy and a picture of John Turturro, and, boy, they looked like twins.
Yeah. I remember people were like, oh, it doesn't look good, you know, and I think it's because you're not used to seeing John Turturro with that ears like that, but you're used to them on Billy, and it, your mind kind of does a little weird matrixing kind of thing on that. I love the choice of Oliver Platt as George Steinbrenner, and not doing a caricature, because, again, this was, you know, the Seinfeld caricature of George was so still prevalent even in 2007 that I loved what Oliver Platt did with George Steinbrenner. Really tried to find the man inside the cartoon that he had become in pop culture media. I love connections in pop culture, especially when they intersect with my life. And one of the funny facts that I found out recently, the actor who played my dad, Josh Pice, who my dad said looked the part, but his voice was too high. And I love that criticism. He said, he doesn't have my broadcasting voice, you know, but because he looks great, though. And he was actually in another pop culture phenomenon, a movie called Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which is based on a comic book that became a cartoon that became a huge thing. And this movie came out in like 1990. I'd never seen this movie, but I had to see it recently for another podcast I do because we were reviewing it. And Josh Pice actually plays one of the turtles in that movie. So he's the guy in the suit and doing the voice. And he does this thick Brooklyn accent for that for that particular turtle character.
That
was a neat little pop culture connection. Yeah. Now, speaking of Brooklyn, like my father, you were born in Brooklyn, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And unlike my father, you became a Yankees fan in 1955.
Yeah, I was only 7 years old, and the Dodgers beat the Yankees for their only world championship ever. They beat them in the World Series, and I was 7 years old, but looking out my brownstone second floor window in Bedford-Stuyvesant, I saw people literally dancing in the street the way we read about it today. And it was such a joyous day, and all I could think was feeling terrible for the losers, the Yankees. And so I took it to heart, and I decided that day that I was going to cheer for the underdog and be a Yankees fan. All these years later, I'm still a Yankees fan, and in that sense, my whole life has been a mistake. I was supposed to be a Dodgers fan.
The perception of my father, because he is so connected with the Yankees, was that he was a Yankees fan as well. He loved it when they won because it did help his circulation and his sales. But he was a lifelong Brooklyn Dodger fan. So when the Dodgers left, left Brooklyn. He didn't even become an LA Dodgers fan. He didn't latch onto the Yankees. He didn't become a Mets fan later on. he had friends in all the organizations. There's no doubt about that. But he was a Brooklyn Dodger fan through and through. And he, two times I saw him, I actually saw him cry. One was the end of Field of Dreams when we were, when we saw it in the theater for the cat. I know you talk about the Field of Dreams a little bit in your book as well. But in the, the scene where they're having catch at the end, that moved him. He rolled a tear at that. And I thought that was a really nice moment, to experience as his son. The other time we were in Cooperstown, and I think it was when Carl Ostrinsky was getting inducted to the Hall of Fame that summer. And we were doing the museum tour, and I kind of lost track of him. And he was in the Ebbets Field display, where they have like a mock-up of the facade, and they're playing. Yep. There used to be a ballpark around here. And I walk in, my dad's just standing there. And just, again, another tear, coming out his eyes, just kind of just remembering his team, and that always struck me because, for me, yes, the Yankees have always been my team as well. And it's this sort of this feeling that we have, that pride that we have for that team that we love. And I love that you got into the Yankees because they were the underdogs, because, look, for a good portion of Yankees history, they have been the underdogs. They have this stigma as being, one of the, not stigma, but yeah, they're one of the winningest teams in baseball, but there have been a lot of lean years. And, as a fan, how do you get through?
Well, we're going through that now, aren't we? I mean, they've only been, people talk about they haven't won a World Series since 2009. But the full story is they've only been in one World Series in the last 20 years. So for people who enjoy the Yankees in hard times, this is their era. They get to enjoy this. As for me, I became a Yankee fan in 1955 instead of the Dodgers. Had I become a Dodger fan, they would have broken my heart 2 years later moving to Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. So it all turned out well.
Exactly. And look, I mean, I think going, midpoint of the season right now, I think we've had, some ups and downs. I think last night was certainly a milestone, clearly, in Yankees history, and an incredible achievement, the perfect game. And it gives it some things like that do give fans hope. When he's not hurt, Aaron Judge, especially the season he had last year, I think that sometimes, it does fall on the individuals. I remember when I was younger, it was Don Mattingly, and it was, Don Mattingly is going to be the guy to take us to the series, and then you're reminded, it's kind of a nice lesson because you're reminded it's not about the individual, or it's not all about the individual. It is about the team and how the team works together, and how they can find their rhythm. And the Yankees always do seem to find their rhythm midpoint in the season, so they can really get our hopes up and then take us to that point of, what has been sheer disappointment in the fall, but still reaching for something, still looking forward to something. And I think that's what we look for as well in our
I'm glad you mentioned Mattingly, because my son is 44, and that was his favorite player growing up. He had posters in his room and everything, and what a role model and what an idol Mattingly was. And I saw the terrific Yogi Berra documentary that's out now called It Ain't Over, and lots of sound bites in there from people who had an association with Yogi. And when Don Mattingly came on the screen, I almost choked up with emotion, just how much I love that guy and what he meant in my household and with my son. So he has a special place in my heart.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. He's still got to cut those sideburns, though. They're a little too long. speaking of your son and your daughter, I do love to talk about, what it does mean to be a father, because I am the son of a father, and this is a legacy show in honor of him. Your son Brian has a great gig. He every summer he puts together the Boston Music Festival, Boston Common Music Festival,
Boston Calling.
Boston Calling. Thank you. Yes.
Boston Calling Music Festival. It's a 3-day festival over Memorial Day weekend every year that features like 50 or 55 bands over the 3 days on the athletic fields of Harvard. That's where they set up the stages. And they sold over 100,000 tickets this year. It's really a major New England event. And I'm very proud of him for what he launched 10 years ago.
10 years ago. Wow. That's great. That's great.
We have
and
an understanding.
Your daughter,
now, if I may, we have an understanding, he and I, that if I heard of the band, he doesn't book it.
Well, you know what? I got to say, he books a great band. So, yeah, keep, keep going on that track there.
Right. Bands you know, but I don't.
Yeah. And your daughter, she does event promotion?
Yeah, she's an event planner. She's worked for MLB. She's worked for CBS. And she just got back from the Cannes Film Festival for her current employer where they entertain clients in Cannes for a week. So that's a pretty good gig, too.
That's a really good gig, yeah. That's fantastic. Did she see the new Indiana Jones movie? Did she like it?
Did she like it? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, because I know it played at Cannes, but apparently it only got like a 7-minute standing ovation at Cannes, which apparently means it was not good at all.
Oh, really? Interesting. No, she actually just got back last night, so we haven't spoken yet.
Gotcha. Cannes the only place where a 7-minute standing ovation means it's a bomb.
That's funny. I will ask her.
So, yeah. Now they both. Now this is really interesting because both of your children have a mutual friend, independently of each other, apparently. That is also a mutual friend of mine, and.
Really?
Oddly enough, I just realized my next guest also has met this person, Lane Wortherly. Lane Wortherly I met while I was living up in Burlington, Vermont. He was sort of my my Qui-Gon Jinn of mentor of navigating the nightclub world when I was started there as a co-check girl at Club Metronome and eventually worked my way up to general manager at that venue. And he kind of helped show me through the ropes. He kind of helped bring me through that world and has been a very good friend, throughout that time. And apparently, yeah, he met your son in college, University of Massachusetts.
Right.
And later on met your daughter. I want to say up in Vermont, I think he had mentioned, but realized that he knew both of them. And then when I first advertised this, we were supposed to do this a couple months ago, he reached out. He goes, I know, I just made this connection that I know both of his kids and that you know them as well. And he goes, I should have figured because of the Yankees. Yeah. So since this episode is all about the Yankees and since Lane has a connection to all of us, I think I'm going to go ahead and just dedicate tonight's episode to Lane, which is perfect because he is a Boston Red Sox fan.
Perfect.
So, Marty, just in the last minute or so that I have you, I just want to talk really quick about a photo that someone found a few months ago that I think I shared with you. It's of you, my father, and Joe Donnelly, who we sadly lost not too long ago as well.
Right.
And I love this photo. First of all, you guys look like some sort of Euro rock band, like the Kraftwerks or something. You and my dad are both wearing black turtlenecks. And Joe's got this really neat sort of burgundy polo, I guess. It's a black and white photo, but it looks sort of like a reddish kind of thing. And my dad's rocking his sideburns, and you look like you're double-fisting what looks like at least one hand has a can of Foster's beer, like a giant beer can. In the time we have left, what can you tell me about that picture?
The New York chapter of the Baseball Writers Association, which your dad chaired for several years, they used to have an annual outing at Bear Mountain, where we would just sort of take over Bear Mountain Lodge, and it was all the New York sports press corps, along with Yankees and Mets front office people. And those were great days and great memories. And I'm glad you brought that up because it triggers that great memory for me as well.
Ah, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Well, Marty, thank you for so many great memories as a Yankee fan and as a Pepe. You really have meant a lot to our family, and thank you again for presenting the Phil Pepe Sports Journalism Excellent Scholarship at Montclair State University back in May for us. Thank you for writing this book. Thank you for being you. Folks, Pinstripe by the Tail, Half a Century in and Around Yankees Baseball by Marty Appel. Go and check this book out. You know, buy it physical. I think you can get it digital. Is there an audio version at some point? Or
no probably? Audio yet. There is a digital and a hardcover.
Right on. Well, if you do go the audio route, I hope you do what Mike did with some of his books and read it yourself, because I think that would be a real treat for people.
I did do that once with my Casey Stengel biography. I got to read it. It took 6 days, and it was a treat. I love doing that.
And I hope you get to write more books. I especially love that you write a lot of books for younger readers, because as you mentioned earlier, it is very important to keep the young generation interested in the things that we love so that the things that we love can be carried on and continue. So, Marty, we're going to let you go. Thank you so much for giving you your time tonight. Please, if you'd love, come back and do it again. Maybe write another book just so you can come back and we can do this again. Or just
really enjoyed being with you. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you for being here. Really appreciate it as well. God bless you, Marty.
Bye now.
Bye. All right, folks, so that was Marty Appel, just a true gentleman and clearly a scholar and just an all-around great guy, and which is a great segue for my next guest this evening. He is also a true gentleman, a scholar, a great guy, somebody who has also been a mentor to me throughout my college years and into adulthood, someone who's introduced with me to so many great experiences. We've shared so many great things over the years. He is a pop culture guru. He is a Yankees super fan. He is a real-life zealot as well, beyond just the Yankees and sports world. I present to you, folks, one of my best and dearest friends, a true big brother, a man who does know that Yankees is the best, or is the baseball. Ladies and gentlemen, Matthew Demick.
Hey, John, I'm thrilled to be part of the pep talk tonight. How are you?
Excellent, Matt. Thanks for coming on. How about that? Marty Appel, huh? Talking Yankees baseball.
You know, it's interesting. I'm a lot like Marty. He likes to write books about the Yankees. I like to read books about the Yankees. So we have a lot in common. And I really identified with what he said about growing up with the Yankees as the underdogs, because you and I both grew up in the 80s, and the Mets were the kings of the town. So, you know, I went to Yankee Stadium plenty when I was a kid simply because there were throwaway Yankee tickets. People didn't want to go. But we got to see Ricky Henderson. We got to see Don Mattingly. We got to see Ron Guidry and Goose Gossage, Willie Randolph, you know, great, great players. So, yeah, I felt the same way. I grew up with the Yankees as the underdog. And, they sure have felt like the underdogs again recently, except for last night. Last night was awesome.
Yes, yes. Now, I know you go to a lot of games. You did not get to go last night, right?
Well, it was in California last night, and although I would have loved to take the trip, I'm here on the East Coast, so, you know, I was lucky that I was able to stay up late enough to watch it, much less being there. But, you know, very early on, and you've known me for a long time, became a Jimi Hendrix fan. And Jimi asked the eternal question, are you experienced? And, you know, I always wanted to be a part of it. I always wanted to feel the roar of the crowd, not just hear it, not just watch it, but actually be a part of it, be surrounded by it.
Yeah.
So living in New York City, you have access to the greatest places on the planet. Yankee Stadium, Madison Square Garden, Radio City Music Hall. And, you know, a lot of times seeing a great moment, the magic, part of that electricity, part of that energy is being in the right place at the right time. And, you know, people think, oh, being at the right place at the right time. Yeah, sure. That's, you know, you got to be really, really lucky, you know, for that to happen. But you can actually pick the right place, and then you just have to wait for the right time. You know, a lot of times going to a Yankee game is like going to a concert, going to, you know, any other live event. You never know what's going to happen. Anything can happen, especially with baseball. With baseball, anything can happen. You can see something that has never happened before in 150 years. You know, like last night. So many records last night. You know, now, you know, with the way that they quantify all the statistics and sabermetrics, you know, computer software programs are coming up with statistics that you would have never even thought of for games like last night, where they can process all the data from, you know, the four perfect games that happened in Yankees history and the 24 perfect games that happened in baseball history. And they can break those numbers down. There's truth in numbers. You know, that's something that always attracted me to baseball. So, you know, you've got the numbers, which, you know, tell the story, but then there's also the intangible, which is being there, feeling the roar of the crowd, stomping your feet on the cement, you know, throwing popcorn up in the air. And, you know, it's all part of the experience. So, yeah, I've always, wanted to be where the action was.
And you've managed to do that pretty well. On average, how many games do you think you you get to a year?
Listen, first of all, I'll never turn down a ticket. So if you're offering, I'll go with you tomorrow night. But, you know,
I wish I was able to get tickets like I used to.
Oh, well, you know, don't we all? But I try to get to as many games as I can. The older I get, the harder it is to get out to the ballpark. But you got to make it. Got to make it a priority. You know, for me, I don't care if they win or lose. It's all about, you know, going out to the stadium. You know, it's a ritual. And, you know, sometimes you take the 4 train out there, you come through the tunnel, you see the bright light of the daylight for the first time when you come out from the subway. You know, it's a whole experience. And now, you know, I have a son, and I'm happy to experience it with him the same way that I did with my dad when I was a kid, and you know that I did with you when we were, you know, in our younger days. But yeah, like I said, between 5 and 10 games a year. But when you go year after year after year, they add up. The most I ever did was in 2008, the last season at the old stadium. I went to the last 11 games in a row.
That's right.
I also went to the All-Star game there that year, went to the last home run derby there where Josh Hamilton had that spectacular showing. You know, you got to be in it to win it. Getting a ticket to a sporting event or a concert is just like buying a lottery ticket. You never know what you're going to get, but you got to be in it to win it.
Marty has this interesting thing in the new book about for a lot of his experience, whether it's a sporting event or a concert or a movie, or even like he'll have this knack for remembering where he was sitting, but not necessarily maybe some of the plot will escape him or some of the set list will escape him or who won the game might escape him, you know, but he has this knack for remembering where he was sitting at a lot of these events. And I think that that does really speak to the experience that you're talking about, the energy of just being there, that sometimes you remember the event and the feeling and the emotion. And then you know, because that's very primal but some of the facts you will need to be reminded. And then when you're reminded of those facts, that triggers another even greater wave of, I think, an emotional response, emotional memory response as well, because now you're puzzled there. Because I find that, too. I find there's a lot of events that I've been to. It's like, I remember where I was sitting. I couldn't tell you what happened for most of it, but I remember where I was sitting. Some of it is memories. Some of it is, you know, recreational chemistry and whatnot. But and some of it, yeah, it's just time and tide, you know, can kind of erase that. But I there's a lot of things that I've been at where I can remember where I've been. And a lot of them, you know, you're right there next to me too, which is pretty cool to have that as part of the memory and the experience.
Well, you hit the nail right on the head.
Thank you.
You hit the nail right on the head, and it's memories. And that's the difference between watching something on a DVD and being there. It's that when you're there, it becomes a part of your DNA. It informs your life decisions because you lived it. You walked through it. You have memories of it, and you experienced it. You know, it's that ultimate experience that we learn from that, you know, brings us to our next journey, right?
Yeah, exactly. Now, Matt, what would you say would be your top Yankees memory that you were there for?
Well, you know, like you just said, sometimes you remember the seat you were sitting in, but you couldn't remember what happened at the game. You know, there are those moments that have nothing to do with the ball game that are the special ones to me, like bringing my son to his first game. Or when I went to my first game with my dad, I will never forget walking up the tunnel in the second tier of Yankee Stadium and seeing that green grass for the first time. It changed my life. And now every time I go to a ballpark, no matter what ballpark it is in America, when you walk through that tunnel and you see that green grass, there's no feeling like that in the world. It's like you walk into another dimension. And it's a dimension where you don't have to worry about what's going on at work or, you know, we all have, life is hard for everybody. We all have our battles. We all have our challenges. But when you get to the ballpark, you can forget about that for 2.5-3 hours and, you know, let them battle it out on the field. But back to your question. Yeah, I have those moments to me that are the most special. And those are the ones with friends and family and, you know, those special moments going to the first Yankee game that I went to with my wife. And, you know, I'll embarrass her. She was I was trying to explain things to her. And she was very embarrassed because she didn't want to feel like, you know, she didn't want everybody who's sitting around us to know that, you know, she wasn't as hardcore of a fan as the Yankee fans were back in the 90s. You know, you couldn't go into Yankee Stadium and not meet a hardcore maniac. But you know, I went first date with my wife to Yankee Stadium was when Roger Clemens had first come to the team. And I really wanted to see him pitch in pinstripes. Got great seats, and, you know, those memories are the ones you really remember. I've seen some, you know, awesome moments. Earlier I mentioned Josh Hamilton's performance. I saw August 10th, 1995, doubleheader at Yankee Stadium. I saw Mariano Rivera was the starting pitcher of the first game. Strawberry Man hit his first Yankees home run in that game as well. I might be wrong about that. But in the second game of the doubleheader, Mike Stanley hit 3 home runs, and the Yankees lost 10-9. That was when I went to a playoff game one night where Jeter went 5-for-5. It was 2005 or 2006. All-Star game, home run derby. Went to a couple of great playoff games in the new stadium. The most special moments though are the like you said earlier, the ones that you share with your friends and your family.
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite Yankee Stadium moments, at least especially for the new stadium, because I think I've only been there a handful of times, was actually, I think, the last Yankee game that I went to, which was the Old Timers Day game a few years back. And it was the first Old Timers Day game after my father passed. And you specifically made it your mission to bring me and my wife to that game because you knew that they would have my dad on the in memoriam, you know, on the billboard there. And that was a 1 second of my life that will forever be frozen in amber. And it was in that moment, and it is always
mine too.
Just the world really just stood still for a moment, and I could just sort of soak it all in. And see my dad's name there right on that billboard at Yankee Stadium with pretty much a packed house because it was a beautiful summer day. And, you know, I will always be forever grateful to you for bringing me to that moment and for being able to catch that picture because I was just stunned. I couldn't get it in time. You know, there's many other things that I'm grateful to you for. That will always serve as one of my greatest Yankee moments, you know, and I thank you for that, for making
mine
me,
too.
You know, be able mine to be too. There for that.
Yeah. Well, that's what it's all about, right?
Baseball,
you know, baseball is a link, you know, between generations. You know, Old Timers Day, mm-hmm. you go there to see your parents' generation's team. You know, you go there to see the old guys. And it's the same game. It's the same fields. It's the same dimensions. You know, it's the same, you know, three strikes, four balls, doesn't change. So you can compare mm-hmm. players from 100 years ago to players who are playing at this exact moment and make an accurate comparison. But, you know, Old Timers Day is where you honor that legacy and where you honor the links to the past. Your parents, your grandparents' generation. You know, my grandmother was a Mets fan. She used to go with the ladies on her floor in Jackson Heights. They used to get cheap tickets. They go $5. They sit in the upper deck, and they'd have a ball. They didn't care if the Mets won or lost. Most times the Mets lost. But for her, it was about going out to the ballpark with the ladies, having a nice night, getting out of the house, getting some exercise, getting some fresh air, and, you know, rooting for your team. You know, I think about my grandmother all the time when I go to games and how proud she'd be of my son, you know, her great grandson, and how much he's a baseball fan. And I know that, you know, in the future, he'll go to games with his son and they'll go. Listen, my son was born on Old Timers Day. So we always make that our family tradition to go to Old Timers Day every year. And, you know, it's kind of a nice family outing, and you have those links to the past where you can tell stories and, you know, Harrison can, my son can, you know, tell about the time that he saw Mariano Rivera, one of the greatest pitchers in history, hit an inside the park home run at Yankee Stadium. I mean, you know, like that's the kind of magic that happens on Old Timers Day. And we got to share that together.
Exactly.
And, you know, those are the links that, you know, kind of bond the generations. And, you know, a lot of the memories that you have with your dad are manifested in the Yankees. A lot of memories that most men have with their parents or with their fathers or, you know, or through sports and through those shared experiences. And, you know, you don't want to remember the bad times. You want to remember that time your team won the World Series and it was amazing. The perfect game, the first one in, you know, since 1999 for the Yankees. You know, those are the things that kind of bond us together. It's all part of the human experience. And if you don't take part in it, you miss out, right?
You know, it's funny because growing up with my dad, a lot of my game experience, there are plenty of memories of going with, you know, with my siblings or with my friends and experiencing the game with them. And I have memories of watching games with my dad. But a majority of my experience was because my dad was working. And this also would come into play during the All-Star games because every summer, for a few years, my dad would take me, you know, because he was covering the All-Star game. We would go to that city. We would spend the week in that city. I would autograph hunt in the hotel lobby, where the players were staying, while my dad was doing stuff during the day. And then we'd go to the game, and, you know, whatever, and he would be working. So a lot of my experience, though, actually going to ballparks especially Yankee Stadium, was by myself. I would, go in with him, and then I would be at my seat by myself. And it was really cool because I associated independence with it, especially when you were in a different city, right? Like being in like Cincinnati or, or Anaheim, and just walking around the stadium by yourself, and given this freedom and this sort of independence. But yet you're also sharing an experience with all of these people, and so that was really cool, I think, to experience growing up, being able to have, both that community experience with my close friends and family watching games, but also that sort of latchkey kid experience, being in Yankee Stadium and just kind of like, just being able to take care of myself, watch the game. You mentioned the lean years earlier. I definitely remember during, one of the lean years, I think it was 1988, the game was just like so dreadful that really just in between innings, I just started reading the new Wolverine number one comic that had come out, his first ongoing monthly series, not the original miniature. It's pretty beat up, that one. So that is my cherished copy, right? My reader's copy. But, just being able to sort of grow up in Yankee Stadium and other ballparks to a degree was another thing, that I am always grateful that my father passed down to me, that sort of independence, and being comfortable within that sort of environment, was a very much a great lesson growing up, and has helped me a lot over the years as well. especially being in strange cities, go to see bands, and getting separated from your friends and stuff. So
you were like Eloise, that little girl who lived in the hotel, but the Yankee Stadium version.
But with Yankee Stadium, yeah. So, but again, not just Yankee Stadium as well. Like, I got to explore a bunch of stadiums like that, over the years. Again, that really did come into play, especially, in other cities. Because it was just me and my dad going to the All-Star games, and my siblings wouldn't be there with me. And occasionally I would bring a friend. A couple summers I was able to bring friends and stuff for that week. But yeah, a lot of times it was just me rolling around strange stadiums. If my mom knew this back then, she would lose her mind.
Right, I was going to say, you're lucky you
didn't. So worried.
That sounds awesome, though. Which was your favorite ballpark outside of the tri-state area?
That's a good question. You know what? I have to say, and oddly enough, this is not a major league ballpark. I can't even remember if it still exists. But we went to the very first minor league All-Star game up in Buffalo,
wow,
New York. At Pilot Field. And
nice.
Pilot Field, I felt, was a really beautiful stadium. It was a AAA stadium, but it really felt like a big league stadium. And it just had a real nice, almost 1920s baseball stadium aesthetic. I always loved the classics. I always loved the original iterations of Yankee Stadium Shea Stadium, and even the Polo Grounds, such a beautiful, beautiful ballpark. Wrigley Field, I love original flavor stuff. The USS Enterprise, right? The original flavor,
yep.
USS Enterprise, any day of the week, So that, to me, that vibe that Pilot Stadium had, it just really felt like a really nice, classic ballpark, even though it was pretty new at the time. But this is what, 1989, 1990? So, yeah.
Well, my
so,
favorite
in the few...
book. Oh, sorry.
Yeah,
I was.
No, go
I
ahead,
was going
to
say my favorite baseball book is actually about old ballparks that don't exist anymore, and minor league, but also early days of baseball, 1800s when they built ballparks out of wood, and I got it at the Strand Bookstore. Old book. Mm. And there's an inscription inside from 1994. The date is Christmas 1994. It's either to a father, to a son, or a friend, to another friend. And it says, if there is no baseball, we will find baseball. And that was the year of the strike.
Nice.
So, it's a baseball relic in its own. But I love looking at pictures of those old ballparks. I love looking at the people in the crowd. They're always all wearing – the men are always wearing hats. A lot of times they're wearing ties, but
always have hats on. A lot of times they have pipes or cigars. And I love just, you know, looking through those old pictures at all the little faces in the crowd, somebody that went to a game 100 years ago and never thought that in 100 years some goofball would be sitting there with a magnifying glass looking at what's in his pocket.
Nice, nice. So, Matt, we have just about 5 minutes left here on this special edition of the Pep Talk. And I refer to you as a real-life Zelig. I know you have met many famous people over the years, mainly right place, right time, but also you think you kind of make it your mission as well to be right place, right time. Are there any particular Yankee encounters that you would like to, or at least one big encounter that you'd like to share with us? You share one, and I'll share my quick Reggie Jackson story.
Well, wait a minute. First of all, 5 minutes. My agent told me I'd get the full hour.
You know what? We're going to be in negotiations. We're going to get you back for a full hour, so, because I definitely knew a half hour wasn't going to be enough.
I'm just kidding. I fired my agent when they booked me on this show. But just to answer your question, I will tee up your your Reggie Jackson story with a Reggie Jackson story of my own.
Nice.
You know, I'd love to get to the ballpark early. You know, it's great to be there and watch the whole place come alive, you know, but always try to get there early to watch batting practice and see the player interactions. You know, a lot of times you see stuff happen during batting practice that you would never see on TV or, you know, during the game. But, you know, here comes Mr. October strolling across the field, and he looked right at me, and I said, "Hey, Reggie!" You know, we were right down behind home plate. This was recently. This was like last year. "Hey, Reggie!" And he looked up at me, and he waved, and I felt so good about myself. I thought I was greatest Yankee fan ever. My son said, "Dad, he was waving at the guy behind you."
Guys, your son is great. He's very observant, very smart, great athlete too, in the making as well. That's
for
great.
Sure.
That's a great response from him in that moment. That's very Harris Long.
Well, we were at Wednesday, and he, you know, we were standing out in left field, and Ramiro Mendoza, former Yankee pitcher from the 1996 championship team, was walking across the field and, you know, tossed the ball over to us. You know, that was a fun player interaction. Had a few, but I'd love to hear your story.
So really quick, summer in Anaheim for the All-Star Game, my dad was doing a piece on athletes who had also transitioned into acting. So he interviewed Fred Dreyer, who was doing Hunter at the time, and then Reggie Jackson, who had started to get into some acting as well. And we met up with Reggie in the morning at his garage because Reggie is he's a classic car enthusiast. And we rode in one of his old 1920s roadsters with a rumble seat. Like, I think I sat in the rumble seat, and then they sat up front. That's when I learned what a rumble seat was. And we went to have breakfast so my dad could do the interview with Reggie. And I remember Reggie was sitting in between my dad and I, and they're talking, and I'm eating my pancakes. And they gave me basically an adult-sized fork for my child hand, right? And so I'm kind of struggling with my fork for my pancakes. And Reggie notices this, and mid-sentence while talking to my dad, just turns over to me really quick. He goes, "Choke up on your fork, son." And went right back to finishing talking with my dad. So it was great to get sort of this baseball-like advice, you know, batting advice, batting tips on eating breakfast from Reggie Jackson. I will always remember that. It will always stick out.
We have less than a minute, John.
Yep, that's I was just about to wrap it up there. So, Matt, thank you so much for coming on and talking about your experiences with Yankee baseball.
It was my pleasure.
Marty, I want And we're going to have you definitely have you back. So you should hire your agent just to book the show and then fire him again for rebooking you on the show. But we'll be in touch about having you back. Marty Appel, again, thank you so much for writing that book and for being on the show and finally making that work out. Join us Sunday. My guest will be Brian Scambotti. Folks, thank you again for listening to the Pep Talk. Spread the word. Tell people you know that might like this show that they should listen to this show, because I think people should listen to this show. All right, folks, that's going to be it tonight. Have a great 4th of July weekend. We'll see you Sunday. Bye.